Good afternoon. In a country that boasts about all the cool medical technologies it creates and exports to the rest of the world, it may sound odd that the experts are worried about the quality of health care in the U.S., but a look at the evidence suggests that for all the money, or for all the times that we go to the doctor, for all the money that we spend on medical care, Americans receive the best care, the best available care, only about half of the time. And whether you have health insurance doesn't seem to make much of a difference. Now, it's not that patients should always get what the experts say that they should, but the fact that Americans only get it half of the time suggests that, or leads many to suspect, that quality is lower than it should be and that we are, as the economists say, leaving money on the table. My name is Michael Cannon. I'm our Director of Health Policy Studies here at the Cato Institute, and I wanted to thank you all for coming here today for this discussion about one idea for improving the quality of medical care and its application to one area of our healthcare sector. That idea is called pay for performance, but it's really a specific type of paying for performance where the insurer creates financial incentives that encourage the provider of healthcare to provide high quality care. And we'll be talking about applying that idea to Medicare, the federal health program that covers 40 million Americans who are either elderly or disabled and is the largest purchaser of medical care in the U.S. As the Cato Institute's adjunct scholar David Hyman writes in this book, Medicare Meets Mephistopheles, which will be available for purchase after the forum, Medicare has its own quality problems. Applying pay-for-performance to Medicare is right now one of the hottest topics in health policy and was recently endorsed by the Institute of Medicine. Now, here to discuss this issue with us are four leaders in the field of health policy and pay-for-performance in particular. Leading off our discussion will be, at my far left, Professor David Cutler. Professor Cutler is Yaddo Eckstein Professor of Applied Economics at Harvard University and served on the Council of Economic Advisors and the National Economic Council during the Clinton administration. And he is the author of Your Money or Your Life, Strong Medicine for America's Healthcare System. Following Professor Cutler, we'll hear from Dr. Gail Walensky, a senior fellow at Project Hope and a former administrator of the Medicare program. Dr. Walensky is also the co-chair of the Institute of Medicine committee that endorsed expanding pay-for-performance within the Medicare program. Then I'm going to jump back in with some of my thoughts on pay-for-performance in Medicare. And our final presenter will be Dr. Sandra Gadson. Dr. Gadson is the immediate past president of the National Medical Association and has been a leader in that group's efforts on pay-for-performance. Dr. Gadson is also a practicing nephrologist and the founder of the first freestanding dialysis center in northern Indiana. After Dr. Gadson concludes, we'll take questions from the audience, and then I'll invite you all to join us upstairs in our winter garden for a reception. And with that, I'll turn the lectern over to Dr. Cutler.
Thank you very much. I just observe in passing, I'm from Massachusetts. I worked on the Hillary Clinton health plan, and here I am at the Cato Institute. Forget about next week. The world has changed. I am told, people used to say about here, about folks from Massachusetts, if you took all the people in Massachusetts and lined them up end to end, that would be a good thing. I want to do a little bit of an introduction about pay-for-performance and talk a bit about Medicare. I should start off, though, since I am at the Cato Institute, by reminding you of what the Apostle Paul said about health care a couple of thousand years ago. Apostle Paul said, "The love of money is the root of all evil." He was obviously a single-payer fan. It turns out the great conservative voice in health care was George Bernard Shaw, who wrote, "The lack of money is the root of all evil." Or perhaps Ayn Rand had it right, "So you think that money is the root of all evil? Have you ever wondered, have you ever asked what is the root of all money?" So let me dive in with a couple of observations. One is that medical care is incredibly hit or miss. Oftentimes it is great, and sometimes it is awful. But it is systematically great and awful in some particular ways. It is great in that over time we develop lots of new ways of treating people, They're very expensive, but they're worth a lot to people. People like to live longer, healthier lives. If you ask people what do they want to spend their money on as we get to be a richer country, people say, I want to live. I have enough of the basics of life. I want to live a long time to enjoy them and the non-monetary aspects of life. So we've had a fantastic growth of spending, all of which has contributed to the public welfare. And then, like the drunk at the bar, we have a few too many. So systematically, so in, on top of a great system, systematically we consume too much because we have a hard time saying when. And so the first error of medical care is not calling it quits soon enough. And I don't just mean at the end of life. I mean take any medical condition. There are a bunch of things for that condition which are good. Maybe there's some pills. Maybe there's a test or two. And then we do the test five times and we give seven different kinds of pills. And we go looking for a few other things as well. So we spend a lot of money where we don't particularly need to, even though at core what we're doing is very good. That happens to most everybody. It's more true about the insured than the uninsured, but it's by and large most everybody. On the other side of the coin, the exact same people, while they're getting too much in some circumstances, are getting too little in other circumstances. The same person who winds up when they have chest pain getting several different kinds of stress tests and a few other sorts of things doesn't take diabetes medication regularly, doesn't take antihypertensive agents, doesn't exercise. All of these things that the person knows that the medical system can help the person out with. We know there are systematic ways of changing incentives and of doing provider-based interventions that get people to take better care of themselves. Those exact same people are not doing that. So people are both spending too much and spending too little. A lot of it's great, spending too much, spending too little. And so that's the real quality problem. The quality problem is not the way that I was taught it in Economics 10, which is because of moral hazard in insurance, people use too much care systematically, and the biggest problem is figuring out how to use less, nor is it what one teaches in Health Policy 10 at a School of Public Health, which is the biggest issue is uninsured people and getting them to use more care. It's rather that each of us get the wrong mix. What do you do about that? There are two basic strategies. One strategy is to make consumers more in charge by increasing the information and the cost that consumers pay. This is something that in this room has probably been discussed at great length, so I'm actually not going to have anything more to say about it, other than to say that I think the more interesting strategy is the second one, which is to say to pay the providers differently, to say, look, we know systematically some things are good and systematically some things are bad. Why do we pay the same amount for the things that are done right and for the things that are done poorly? In fact, if anything, in medical care, you get paid more for things that are done poorly than things that are done well. If you have a patient who comes into the hospital with congestive heart failure and you manage to get the patient infected, congratulations, you get more money if you're the hospital. Now, you also bear additional costs, and it's probably not worth it, but still you sort of ask yourself the question, gee, when I go to buy a car, if the car doesn't work or it's broken, I don't actually give the auto dealer more money so that he can give me a better car. You sort of say, gee, if anything, I should pay less for it. But in medical care, the opposite is true. In fact, there are only two industries in the entire economy I can think of where doing a better job doesn't result in more revenue. One is healthcare, and the other is public schools. And there's a reason why we think of the quality in each of those as being relatively mixed. So the basic tenet that I have, and I call it a tenet, as in healthcare, a lot of what people believe is religious belief. That is, they because their theory tells them something, they accept it as true. And I want to try to avoid that here. But the observation is that money drives a lot of what's done, and therefore, if we did a better job of paying for good quality and not bad quality, we would wind up systematically with good quality and not bad quality. That means that we ought to measure performance, and we ought to do payment on that basis writ large. Okay. As a statement, I suspect that most of you will find that relatively unobjectionable. To the extent that people don't like it, it really has to do with, can you actually measure it? Can you do it properly? Will you create as many problems by implementing something like that as you solve by doing it well? So, for example, if you're not measuring outcomes well, if, let's say, you're just paying doctors for selecting healthy patients, then you'll wind up with a medical system where healthy patients will find it easy to get access to care and sick patients will not. So the fundamental issue about this is not the idea that paying more for a good job is a bad idea. It's that paying more when you're not completely certain exactly what is a good job, you may live to regret it. And the truth is we won't know that until we try it, and so that's partly brings up the issue of Medicare. I will just say, in talking about performance, there are a number of different dimensions to performance. One measure which we can come up with sometimes is actual clinical outcomes. For example, risk-adjusted mortality rates for a hospital that's doing bypass surgery. In fact, a number of states, New York State, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and a couple of others, actually collect data on every patient who had bypass surgery in every hospital. They require reporting of the clinical risk characteristics for the patients, and then they come up with rankings about how good the different providers are, and then they release them. The public knows a small amount, not a great deal, about them. The local newspapers find out about them. The boards of directors find out about them, and they seem to get underperforming hospitals to improve somewhat. Bill Clinton had surgery in New York State. There are 32 hospitals in New York State. They're all ranked by the State Department of Health, with number one being the best and number 32 being the worst. President Clinton, former President Clinton, no doubt on the advice of his Cato Institute doctors, went to hospital number 32. They'd probably improved a bit since the rankings had come out. So that's one possible measure. We also know various process measures, things like if patients with diabetes get their eyes examined once a year, you're more likely to spot blindness coming early on. If they get their extremities examined, you're more likely to be able to prevent amputations. If they take their medications, their cholesterol will be under better control, and their blood pressure and their blood sugar levels and so on. So there are various process measures that we can come up with. One of the things about as you get into process measures, it involves more about what the physician and the patient do rather than just what the doctor does. And so you have to decide where to draw the line in terms of we know there are things a doctor can do to get a patient to take medication and to come in, but we also know that some of that's under the control of the patient as well. And so it's a little bit of a difficult issue. But let me just note it and keep going. And then finally, we have measures of patient satisfaction. Did the patient actually enjoy the experience or not? Currently, the only use of these is at a very gross measure. If a surgeon is really bad, he or she might be thrown out of the medical club, although that's very strict. Some insurers might not cover institutions that are not great, but that's, again, very loose. The net impact is basically the playing field is open to virtually all providers, increasingly so since managed care has deteriorated, so there's relatively little incentive to really work on quality, and we find that the quality record is haphazard and remains haphazard. So seems to me obvious we should do something. Then the question is, why Medicare? Why should Medicare do something? And I just want to make a couple of observations. One observation is that changing quality in medical care has an enormous fixed cost. So if you want a doctor to, let's say, treat diabetic patients better, it probably involves a computer system where he or she can track what's going on. It involves special nurses who will coordinate with the patients about routine matters. It involves making sure that when the patient has gone to a specialist, the results actually come back somewhere. So there's a very big fixed cost in improving quality. That means that it's going to be very hard for a small segment of the market to do it well. So if you think about an insurer with 20% of the population, roughly five insurers in a town, including Medicare and Medicaid, deciding to pay 20% more to doctors who do a good job taking care of diabetics, that would be a 4% increase in revenue. That's not enough to motivate someone to completely change the nature of the practice. You've got to get the big gorilla involved. You've got to get a lot of money involved if you're going to overcome fixed costs. An enormous part of the money is in the public sector, Medicare and Medicaid. So leaving Medicare outside of a pay-for-performance system strikes me as just a recipe for finding that, by and large, it's not as successful as it could be. We have to balance, obviously, the potential for harmful outcomes, but it strikes me that if one says off the bat no to having the biggest single payer in the system, that's almost like saying you want to set it up so that the odds of success are 10% or less. So that's one observation. It's sort of compounded by the fact that every insurer has an incentive to free ride off other insurers paying for the computer system, since all the patients would benefit from that. The second observation I would note is that I think of pay for performance as one part of a comprehensive strategy for healthcare reform, not as the sole thing you would do. And I think about two other parts as being important. First is information on who's doing what well and who's not doing it well. And no health reform system, whether you believe in demand-side incentives or supply-side incentives, is going to go very far unless you get that information base out there. That's, again, something where Medicare has been leery, but it could be a big part of the solution. And then the third leg of the stool would be information technology and wiring up the medical system, making it be so that we can actually see what's going on and pay on that basis. So the second point I want to make is that one should not think of pay for performance in isolation or even in opposition to some of the other things that people talk about. Then the final point I would make is just a question of how would you pay for it. And this is probably a bit further afield than we want to go. But there is actually an obvious source of money, which is that under current Medicare forecasts, payments to physicians are expected to fall by about 5% a year, or rather prices to physicians are expected to fall by about 5% a year, because we have the sustainable growth rate, or as we in Massachusetts outside of the Beltway call it, the unsustainable growth rate, that says that when volume of procedures and services goes up, we pay doctors less. Heck, if we keep running this forward, in no time at all, doctors will be paying us to treat Medicare patients. And so it's clear that we're not going to reduce the payments by 25% over the next 5 years. We're going to increase them, and my thought is why increase them across the board the way we always do and get the same outcomes we always get? Why not do something more innovative that says, look, we'll increase the payments if you're doing the right job? I just want to end on two thoughts. One thought is maybe it can't be done. Maybe performance measurement is too hard, in which case we'll learn that, but we're only going to learn that if we experiment. And I'm a little bit concerned that if we experiment without any big payers involved, all we're going to learn is that you do small things, you get small answers, and that's not going to be very effective. The second point I want to make is particular about Medicare, that Medicare used to be a leader in health system change. Back in the early 1980s, Medicare developed, pioneered DRGs, and the private sector followed. And there were some parts of it that were bad, but by and large, I think most people were happy with what went along. It was clearly the right thing to do, moving in that direction. I think at the broad level, most people would agree that moving in the direction of performance-based payment at some level is the right thing to do. And since the early 1980s, Medicare has become in many ways a laggard and a drag on innovation going on in the rest of the medical sector. It would be nice to bring Medicare up to where the rest of the medical sector is again, so that one's not always fighting against the big gorilla that's out there. So that's where I wanted to open things up, and I know the subsequent panelists will talk a bit more about Medicare and hopefully stimulate some debate. Thank you.
I'm going to talk about the report that was recently issued by the Institute of Medicine regarding rewarding provider performance or pay for performance to share with you what this group of individuals has recommended. But I want to end on the issue that David just raised, which is Medicare likely to be able to lead or follow? What do we know, and how can we try to juggle what is going on in the private sector and the public sector so that they can reinforce and help each other as opposed to work in antagonistic ways? This is what the pre-publication volume at least looks like. The actual publication will probably be cleaned up just a little. It's the third in a series of reports that are under the rubric of Pathways to Quality Healthcare, and was involving the same group of individuals looking at redesigning health insurance benefits, performance measures, and pay for performance. It's interesting and consistent with what David said to note that the first volume in the series was on performance measurements because it became quickly clear that an interest in looking at pay for performance required some assessment about what kind of performance measures are out there, what's the state of the world with regard to performance measures, how might you want to proceed in the future, what's probably possible either technically or realistically in the next 3 to 5 years so that you have an idea about the potential out there. Because as you've already heard, many of the concerns or qualms about pay-for-performance type strategies have to do with the measurement systems and whether they are approximately robust enough or adequate enough that you are more likely to do good than to do harm. And that's certainly a fair consideration. However, when it comes to Medicare, it seems to me that you could really say that the incentives have basically gotten it wrong for the last 20 years, improved over what was previously there. That is, it is fair to say that moving to a bundled payment like DRGs, where you have a single payment for a discharge, made much more sense than paying on a daily basis when you know that later days had declining marginal cost, so that at least you could encourage some efficiency. But that as a reward system for the institutions or the clinicians who do it well, do it right the first time, and provide the kind of services their patients want, Medicare has certainly not gotten it right. Somebody who ran the program, who's chaired two congressional commissions on Medicare, I feel like I'm at least as entitled to say we've gotten it wrong over this last period. Now, it's not that people haven't thought that there was something fundamentally amiss, but as you well know, the way that pricing is set up under Medicare is determined legislatively through the Congress under an administered pricing system. And the basic way it works is first in class, best in class get paid exactly the same amount. You have further the perverse incentives that David alluded to, which is if you don't do a very good job, have complications, need to readmit people, or basically clean up your mistakes, you get paid more. If you spend a little extra time with your patients, practice in a conservative manner, have good outcomes, you financially suffer. For most economists, this is not really the kind of system that you'd like to see in place, nor, when you look around the country, is it the kind of reimbursement system that you would normally see elsewhere, where first year, those with great experience, those with good outcomes, those with poor outcomes, all are paid the same. Once you make some adjustments for cost of living, if you're a hospital, whether you have a teaching program or not, which is designed to reflect some cost differences experience, no allowance or adjustment for those who get the best clinical outcomes. Now, if you get one of these bundled payments, and that means hospitals and nursing homes to an extent and home care to an extent, you at least can receive some benefit by being efficient if you can do better than the average. If you're a physician, you actually don't even have that possibility because the fee schedule is very disaggregated. Some 7,000 plus codes on a system that goes up to 9,000 or so CPT codes. Now, I'm mentioning this because while I was quite daunted by the difficulty that it will be to change the reimbursement system so that it properly is designed as a pay-for-performance system, when I would get really depressed or frustrated about all of the change that would be needed to occur, I'd think about where we are now. And it was relative to that, it was hard to imagine not being able to do a better job if you did it carefully, if you phased it in, if you had a number ways to try to modify unintended consequences. What we are doing now, where best in class, worst in class, exactly the same amount, it makes so little sense that it encouraged me and I think our group to go forward. One of the primary conclusions of the report is that the Medicare payment system, as it is currently configured, is fundamentally broken. We are not encouraging high-quality, efficient, patient-centered care, and that is a fundamental problem, nor is it ever going to change if we don't make some significant changes to how Medicare reimbursement occurs. In coming up with a set of recommendations, This was a group that was made up in the subcommittee of half of the people who were on a full committee and half of the people who were asked to come join to help opine on these issues, and then a set of reviewers. It obviously is not constructed to be broadly reflective of what the world thinks about these issues, but at least to get a significant mix of people who are physicians from the payer world, from hospital administrator, those of us who are policy analysts, who've been in government, who've not been in government, to try to be able to reflect all of the views and insights on this. So let me share with you now some of the recommendations. It starts by acknowledging of all of the kinds of problems that we know exist with the healthcare system, where we spend a lot of money, but find that there are real problems in terms of both patient safety and people getting the clinically appropriate care most, yet alone, all of the time. Changing the reimbursement system is not a panacea. This is not the only kind of a change that needs to occur, but it's an important change. And, of course, for an economist, you don't really need to spend a lot of time saying information is important, systems are important, making sure we don't have unhelpful drivers like liability out there is important. But incentives count, too, and that's where we're focusing on this. First thing is use a phased-in approach. We recognize that there is a lot of change that needs to occur, and it ought to occur in steps. Second thing, and this is an issue that came up particularly from the provider community, which is by and large use existing funds, set aside an amount that looks like it will begin to make some difference, except in the case for physicians, for the reasons that David already indicated, that physicians are scheduled under current law to basically be facing 4 or 5% reductions in prices for the next 4 or 5 years. You're going to have to put more money into the pool to respond to that. Now, it's important to understand that while physicians have gotten very small price increases over the last 4 or 5 years, 1 year the actual was reduction, in the other 4 previous years there have been very small changes. It's not like spending isn't growing up by gangbusters. In the year in which prices went up 1.5%, spending under Part B went up 15%. But it's all the more frustrating because, again, the most conservatively practicing physicians, the most aggressive physicians, the physicians that have good clinical outcomes and pay attention to their patients and respond in appropriate ways get paid exactly the same amount. In fact, you can say they actually, the ones who are the ones you would like to reward the most, actually get penalized the most. They get the same fee reductions everybody else does, and no way to be rewarded for the kinds of positive impacts that they're doing. So we recognize need to phase in. In general, when it comes to hospitals and renal dialysis and home care, we think there's enough money that's going in each year into the healthcare system. Special problems for physicians, and we want to acknowledge that. We want to start with provider-specific pools because that's how best to try to respond. So a pool for physicians, a pool for hospitals, pool for nursing homes. That means you're not taking away from, you're redistributing money in terms of some increment. We're thinking basically of a couple percentage points, what may well be the update, but not necessarily in terms of Medicare payment. Ultimately, this ought to be regarded as a consolidated pool and feeds off the recommendations with regard to the performance measurement, which is we need to move away from these very siloed, very specific encounter ways of looking at how patients interact with the healthcare system and begin to construct measures that look at all of the people and institutions that touch a patient for an episode of illness. And when it comes to chronic care, which is a big part of healthcare costs, to do it over some defined time period. But we are where we are, so we recognize that both for performance measurements and for payments, we're going to need to start a physician encounter, physicians separate from hospitals, separate from nursing homes, but be able to ultimately cross these silos. We need to make sure that it's not just efficiency that's rewarded, not just quality that's rewarded. If you think these three areas, patient-centeredness, quality, and efficiency, are important, you better reward for all three, or don't be surprised when you drive the system only to one direction. All the docs on the group were worried, and nurses and other clinicians were worried that we would only reward for efficiency. All the economists said all the attention has been on having quality measurements. We're worried you're only going to reward on quality and drive up spending yet more. The point really is you really need to reward on those things that you want to encourage. Initially, you need to recognize it's both improvement and attainment. Those that do very well, but you need to be able to reward for improvement. Ultimately, we would like to have the improvement get a little less of a weight, and we would hope that the very bottom tier gets forced up over time or forced out. Whether or not there will be the political will to do that is another discussion. It's important to start rewarding the reporting of quality information. I have to admit I've had somewhat of a change of heart. Initially, when the Medicare Modernization Bill was passed in 2003, which gave hospitals a monetary incentive for rewarding quality data, my attitude is you can give them incentive. You want to get money from Medicare, report the quality data. Don't give them more. But I have to admit that the numbers pre the incentive were running a little under 50%, and now it's about 98.5%. So if we've waited this long, two more years won't hurt. Have the initial incentive be to report quality information and then move to actually rewarding for performance. But I'll concede to starting there. We need to make sure the information is transparent and publicly available. This is important so that physicians and hospitals and nursing homes know how they stack up, but patients need to know so they can make good decisions. Other payers need to be able to know as well. Having data very transparent is extremely important. We want to try to get all providers who are participating in Medicare to be able to do this, and it means being sensitive that some groups are much farther along than other groups. MedPAC had reported in their pay-for-performance that hospitals, renal dialysis, home care, managed care plans are pretty much ready to go now. Physicians are in a little more delicate state. Some physician groups have been very forward-thinking in trying to do measurements and actually push their own quality and outcomes data. Society for Thoracic Surgeons has been very aggressive in this area. The American College of Cardiology has been quite active. Some areas of medicine have basically been pretending that all of this will go away if they ignore it long enough. They're going to need a little more time. Our recommendation is develop for 3 years the reporting of measures. Give time to have interaction between physicians and the government in terms of having this reporting, then assess whether it's time to go forward in a mandatory type of way. HIT is important, but we would like to not have this health information systems. We want to make sure that health information systems are not used to hold hostage pay for performance. We think when you're paying in this way, rewarding for clinical outcome, and as this becomes a much more prevalent part of the reimbursement, you will have a lot of incentive to adopt the kinds of systems like health information technology that will allow you to more easily report this information. We're very nervous about having movement on one determine the movement on other. And then finally, something called active learning. And that is the realization that we are going to be learning a lot as we go along. We're going to have to allow for adjustments. We're going to have to make those adjustments. I'm almost out of time, but let me just share a couple observations on this. Where can Medicare lead and where can Medicare follow? Medicare can do a lot with regard to the development of these measures, sponsoring groups outside of government to do this work, disseminating information. I think it may be able, because of the pressure on physicians, to use the quid pro quo of if we are going to bail out physicians from the current congressionally created problem, we want something in return, and this is the return we want. In general, it's my observation that government can do least well payment paying groups differentially. And so I'd like to qualify what David said by pointing out that DRGs and RBRVS, the way we pay hospitals and the way we pay physicians, for those of you who are not healthcare aficionados, are pseudoscience to make it look like it's scientifically determined. But the upshot is, once you make the adjustments for cost of living, and whether you're an academic teaching center or the share of labor or whatever, everybody's paid exactly the same, which is a great source of comfort to government. By nature, this type of system is going to mean paying differentially what is nominally the same service provided at different quality or efficiency levels. And that's going to be much tougher for government if it's not being done also in the private sector. Now, fortunately, the private sector is bailing out government in this, because there are over 100 pay-for-performance experiments that are going out in the, on in the private sector right now, some very interesting and very innovative. So this jockeying back and forth about where can the government lead, where can Medicare lead in particular, which is important because it can drive a lot of change. It's a big payer. You can't ignore the 800-pound gorilla. But recognizing that for government to do this, if it's not becoming a well-accepted and used type of system in the private sector, is going to be very difficult. And, oh, yeah, we do recognize, by the way, we're going to drive the physicians and hospitals bonkers if we can't come up with the same system, at least for measurement, not necessarily for payment, but at least for measurement. So that's one more argument for going forward together in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Walensky. There's a lot to be said about this topic, and I'm only going to try to make a few points and then hope that I get asked all the questions that I want to be asked during question and answer period. It's a tricky thing for someone, for anyone, to define quality for anyone other than themselves. And it's true that patients usually don't know what the evidence has to say about what types of medical care produce the greatest health gains. So obviously there's some role for experts to be helping promote quality care. But at the same time, the patient and her doctor usually know things that the expert does not. So even when the evidence is pointing in one direction, the patient and their doctor and her doctor may have information that's pointing in another. To paraphrase Mary Tinetti of Yale Medical School, sometimes doctors are right to deviate from what the experts say is best, based on their knowledge of a patient's characteristics or preferences. And it's really hard to distinguish the appropriate deviations from the inappropriate deviations. Now, having said that, I come here today not to bury pay-for-performance, but to save it. My aim is not to stop pay-for-performance from being introduced into Medicare, but really to stop Medicare from being introduced into pay-for-performance. To that end, I want to argue three things. First, that pay-for-performance is most likely to improve the quality of care for seniors if we employ a diversity of approaches from which seniors are able to choose. Second, that pay-for-performance is likely to end up costing us money and even harming seniors if it is run by Medicare itself. And third, if we're serious about improving quality, we really need to expand our understanding of what pay-for-performance is and how to pay for performance. So let me begin by explaining one way that a pay-for-performance program can create a perverse incentive that could reduce the quality of care or access to care for some patients. Suppose an insurer wants to make sure that patients who have suffered heart attacks get beta blockers. This is a common pay-for-performance measure for which private insurers are trying to reward doctors because beta blockers are proven to increase survival after heart attacks. Well, what about the case of a patient who is, say, and this is an example that I use in the paper that you were given, and it's not my example, I cited there, a patient who's 73 years old. She's already on 11 different medications, and every time she takes a beta blocker, she feels dizzy, she feels weak, which is a sometimes side effect of beta blockers. Now, that patient decides that she would rather face the small added risk of having a second heart attack in the next decade. She would rather face that risk than have to feel this way all the time. Here, that the pay-for-performance incentive that encourages the doctor to prescribe that beta blocker for her creates a perverse incentive for the physician to administer what is undoubtedly low-quality care, what the, you know, something that the patient feels makes would leave her worse off. Now, these conflicts between what the evidence recommends and what is in the interest of patients are actually more likely to occur in Medicare. There are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that Medicare patients are more likely to have these comorbidities or multiple illnesses. Yet, most evidence-based recommendations are based on studies that don't take those sorts of comorbidities into account. So one doctor that follows the clinical practice guidelines for every comorbidity the patient comorbidity that a patient has could end up making multiple prescriptions for the same patient. That patient could end up on an 11-drug regimen, which increases the likelihood that one of those drugs is going to provide negative benefit for her, and also increases the likelihood of adverse drug interactions. So a pay-for-performance system for seniors – I'm sorry, so penalizing providers for deviating from clinical practice guidelines for each one of those comorbidities effectively for providing high-quality care for such patients – could also create access problems for those patients. If it becomes a financial liability for the provider to see those kinds of patients, you can expect we can expect the providers may try to avoid such patients. And there are other examples of pay-for-performance financial incentives in, that would encourage providers to turn some patients into what one observer refers to as medical hot potatoes. Now, this is none of this is to meant to say that pay-for-performance is a bad idea for seniors. I think that it can do a lot of good to improve the quality of care for many seniors. But it does suggest that when a third party is trying to determine quality for a broad and diverse group of patients, there are going to be outliers who don't fit that definition. And those outliers should have the option of opting out of this pay-for-performance program, particularly when the incentives that create when the financial incentives that create that perverse incentive for physicians to provide them low-quality care is completely opaque to the patient. These financial incentives, the patient may not even be aware of the financial incentives and probably isn't aware of the financial incentives that the provider faces. Now, in traditional Medicare, however, that would be near impossible for many patients to opt out of a pay-for-performance program if we have a pay-for-performance program that's administered by the Centers for Medicare and Medicare Services. Seniors can obtain Medicare coverage in basically two ways. There's the traditional Medicare program, which covers about 37 million seniors. Then there's the Medicare Advantage program, which covers the rest, about 7 million, I think. Now, not all seniors have access to a Medicare Advantage plan. So if Medicare adopts and administers a pay-for-performance program, those seniors who are harmed by these sorts of perverse incentives, many of them would not be able to opt out of the traditional Medicare program and into a Medicare Advantage plan. Moreover, even if they could opt out of the traditional Medicare plan and go for a Medicare Advantage plan, it's likely that those plans are going to adopt the very pay-for-performance system that Medicare administers. Why would one of those private insurers that contracts with Medicare to provide Medicare benefits through Medicare Advantage, why would they undertake the extra expense of developing their own pay-for-performance system when Medicare is going to do that for them? And we'd likely see the same thing in the private. In health insurance plans for non-elderly citizens. So, a better option, I would argue, would be instead to allow pay-for-performance into Medicare, but to confine it to those Medicare Advantage plans, where you have different private insurers contracting with Medicare to provide benefits, and where they can experiment with their own pay-for-performance programs. Through a process of trial and error, they'll be able to learn from each other's successes and failures. And importantly, seniors who participate in those programs, if they feel that they are being harmed and their doctor talks to them about how your insurer is really, selling you short and encouraging me to provide you low-quality care, they would have the option to switch out of those programs. We don't know what sorts of pay-for-performance tools work best. We don't know where pay-for-performance will create these perverse incentives, although we have some idea. We have precious little information about how much pay-for-performance programs cost. And we have almost no evidence that they even work. And therefore, we have no way of evaluating whether provider-focused financial incentives administered by a third party, by third-party insurers, will produce the quality gains that are worth the added cost of administering these programs. It's really sort of the emperor has no clothes moment when you stop to consider how little we know about how these programs work and about how well they work and how little we know about how much they cost. There's very little data on either of these issues, and yet a lot of people want Medicare to run whole hog into pay for performance. Now, the Institute of Medicine report does not suggest that, but there are those who do want Medicare to make an even bigger push for pay for performance. So for these and other reasons, I think it's important that Medicare take the cautious approach of limiting pay-for-performance to private Medicare Advantage plans, where it'll continue to benefit from the learning process that it's seen so far. Now, all the unknowns that we face about pay-for-performance bring me to my final point, which is that if we're serious about improving quality, we have to expand what is our understanding of pay-for-performance. When seniors enter the marketplace, the medical marketplace, to purchase either health care or to purchase coverage, they're largely spending someone else's money. That reduces the incentive of every senior to demand quality, either from their health plan or from a provider, because no one spends someone else's money as carefully as they spend their own. No one demands as much information about quality when it's someone else's money as when they're spending their own money. And the pursuit of quality medical care for seniors, I think, has to go beyond the idea of having a third-party payer decide what constitutes quality to consideration of reforms that give seniors, one, ownership over the money that's at stake, and therefore, two, a much greater incentive to demand quality than they have today. Managed care failed in its pursuit to contain costs, I would argue, because it failed to enlist patients in the effort. And I would hate to see a pay-for-performance suffer the same death. Thanks. Suffer the same death, but suffer the same setbacks. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm trying to get this mic. I think I have it here. I am Sandra Gatson. I am immediate past president of the National Medical Association. First, let me thank Mr. Cannon and the staff at Cato Institute for an outstanding symposium that talks about pay for performance. I am now actually the chair of the task force that is dealing with pay for performance, and it's been really a burning issue within the National Medical Association ever since, I guess, it came hot off the press back in 2004, perhaps even prior to that. We have, as you know, the National Medical Association is the oldest African-American health care organization in this country. It represents over 35,000 African-American physicians and the patients that they serve. So there is a great concern with regards to pay for performance. And being a practicing physician, we see it from another angle, and perhaps in the question and answer period I will talk about that, because I'm a nephrologist, take care of people on dialysis, so I see patients at the end of the spectrum. So if we had perhaps better preventive care, I wouldn't see as many patients at the end of the spectrum. And I don't think we really address that when we talk about health care and health care delivery. The NMA remains committed to the highest quality care for all patients and to the optimal delivery of such care under all circumstances. Quality improvement is an important goal for our nation's health care system, and that's what we've been talking about today. But policy initiatives designed to achieve this goal have to carefully scrutinize their potential effect on minority populations, the underserved population, the uninsured population, and, of course, the Medicare population. In this regard, pay-for-performance is a carrot-and-a-stick concept that brings cause for concern. In its evolving form, it offers bonuses for high performers while tightening the purse string for everybody else. This may be a viable approach for improving the quality of widgets produced in a factory. But it will certainly play out very differently when dealing with patients, particularly the populations with the highest rates of morbidity and mortality in this country. I want to share just a few points before I talk about the system of pay-for-performance. A cursory comparison of black and white populations shows that these groups bring substantially different health profiles to the clinical spectrum. Significant racial disparities exist in health status, health system quality and access, healthcare utilization, as well as patient compliance. Let me just mention that in terms of disparities, black Americans lead the nation in 12 of the top 15 leading causes of death. That includes heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and kidney disease. When we look further, we look at the racial disparities among the uninsured. In 2004, there was one out of every three Hispanics and one out of every five blacks, compared to one out of every 10 whites who was uninsured. The uninsured had worse health and higher morbidity compared to the insured. The uninsured are also more likely to forgo needed care and obtain inadequate care for even the most serious illnesses, including end-stage renal disease, hypertension, diabetes, and cancer. The uninsured are also less likely to receive preventive services such as screening for breast, cervical, colorectal cancers, and many of the other issues that prevail. We are concerned, therefore, when we believe in the healthcare safety net, and obviously Medicare is one of those. But we are concerned with regards to the pay-for-performance framework that it should take in mind the millions of the individuals that will be affected by a pay-for-performance system. First, the scientific and clinical data that constitutes the evidence base by which performance is measured should be compiled across diverse populations. In other words, case mix adjustment is a more efficient means of ensuring that physicians who see patients with greater disease burdens are not unfairly compensated relative to physicians who see healthier patients. Secondly, clinical data are probably more reliable predictors of quality improvement than are claims data. Pay-for-performance frameworks should therefore rely more heavily on the former. Third, an undesirable clinical outcome does not necessarily bespeak noncompliance by the provider. Reimbursement mechanisms should reflect the reality that physicians in smaller practices are more likely to be adversely impacted by larger numbers of noncompliant patients, and noncompliance should be appropriately attributed. And let me just say, within our environment, the majority of physicians actually are either one, two, or three man or woman groups. There are very few multi-specialty groups with better than 200 doctors. And I think one of the issues that concerned AMA as well is that when the initial programs were started and the pilot programs, if you will, were started, they were geared toward better than 200 doctor groups in parts of Wisconsin, suburbs of St. Louis, Raleigh-Durham area. And these were in Ann Arbor, I think, was another area. And I singled those out because they were huge multi-specialty groups who had all the information technology, et cetera. So, of course, when you look at that, if I can go into a building and I can get everything that I need done in one-stop shopping, then, yeah, I probably will have better outcomes than if I've got to run all over town or go from the doctor's office to the hospital to get lab work and et cetera done. So these were concerns when we looked at the whole makeup of how pay-for-performance was being designed, that it did not include those doctors who are private, solo practitioners, or who are in two or three-man groups. The design, implementation, and evaluation of pay-for-performance framework should include practicing physicians with expertise in working among populations that suffer the ill effects of ethnic and racial health disparities. The NMA has recommended, therefore, that cultural competency standards be established as a major component of any pay-for-performance framework. We also say that pay-for-performance frameworks and the current sustainable growth rate cannot coexist. SGR must be repealed if pay-for-performance is to have any chance of sustained success. Pay-for-performance reporting requirements must be voluntary in the preliminary stage. Requiring providers to report on quality measures while they are still in their infancy further compounds the challenge of systematic data collection. Health information technology is vital to this process. There must be a national commitment to providing financial and technical assistance to America's healthcare providers in order to facilitate the transition into the digital age. As I stated at the outset, I believe that pay-for-performance is cause for concern. The data is not in, and ultimately, the success or failure of pay-for-performance must be evidence-based. But the concept's efficacy depends on the quality of the evidence by which performance benchmarks are determined. If minority populations are not appropriately factored into the data collection and analysis processes, then the resultant standards would not reflect the actual clinical characteristics of minority patient populations. And if physician practice patterns are not comprehensively factored into the equations, then the resultant standards pose potential danger to healthcare access and care for minority patients. I wanted to just interject that there was some discussion about one of the, I think, the American Thoracic Society, and that they wholeheartedly bought into pay for performance. Well, being a practicing physician, the difference is in that is they can choose who they operate on. But when a patient comes into an emergency room or into an office, that doctor cannot choose, especially in an emergency room setting. They can't say, well, you know, you haven't been to your doctor in 10 years, and you have your hemoglobin A1C is 15, and you haven't had any lab work, and you didn't keep your appointment, and you got a bottle full of medicines, and the date is 10 years before. They can't say we won't see you. But if we create a system with pay-for-performance that rewards those who have good outcomes, per se, and penalizes those who don't have good outcomes, then what happens? There's a shift, and the patients are sent to other places. So we feel strongly that that will actually increase the health disparities, because we have a big issue with health disparities now. So in closing, I saw my five-minute mark here. It is our belief that any quality performance measurement system must be patient-focused. It must have realistic performance standards that reflect population profiles, and it must recognize physician practice patterns and the potential impact of policy on diversity and the viability of minority physicians. So Medicare can be the leader and how pay-for-performance should look and how we should approach it. Thank you.